we pick up then with Bohan, which raises this question of how we apply this standard when a plaintiff is complaining about something being a nuisance. Mr. Walsh, can you tell us about Bohan? Okay, so we've got this factory spewing noxious fumes onto the plaintiff's property. What happens at the trial of the case? And what does the plaintiff argue on appeal? Actually, I don't think it's a little bit confusing here. At the end of page on the right hand column on page 60. Oh, I'm sorry. I think it says there was a verdict for the defendant, but I think they're referring to Heeg versus Licht there. I think in this case, the plaintiff got a judgment. Plaintiff got a judgment, and the defendant appealed the charge or the instruction to the jury. What's the defendant's argument in the Court of Appeals here? Plaintiff gets a judgment that this was a nuisance, and the defendant says there was an error committed by the trial judge. That's the point of the defendant's appeal, that the jury was allowed to impose liability despite the fact that the plaintiff never proved that what the defendant did was negligent. And the question is whether that was an error or not. What's the majority's view of this issue? Does the plaintiff have to prove negligence to recover for an alleged nuisance? What does the plaintiff have to prove? Give me some definition for that. What is a nuisance? What is it that the plaintiff has to prove? Okay, let me give you a hypothetical here. Suppose I'm a musician. I make my living playing at various clubs around town, and my workday generally begins around 1 or 2 in the afternoon when I get up. I do various things and get ready for my evening gig. I show up at the club about 8 o'clock, begin my first set around 9, play often until 1 in the morning, finish playing, still energized, eat dinner, sit around, talk with my friends, finally stumble home, fall asleep around 4 or 5 in the morning, and at 1 or so in the afternoon I wake up and start my day again. That's my life as a musician. My neighbor, however, who likes to play golf, gets up in consideration for his neighbor, waits until 9 a.m. to fire up his lawnmower. Fires up his lawnmower at 9 a.m. and mows his lawn, after which he goes off to play golf. I, as politely as I can, explain to him that 9 a.m. is just when I'm falling into REM sleep, and I find this annoying and offensive. And my neighbor is not very impressed with this. He thinks he'd rather mow his lawn at 6 a.m. so he could get a tea time at 7, but he waits until 9 out of consideration for me. And we can't reach agreement on this. Things degenerate, and I bring a lawsuit to enjoin him from mowing his lawn until noon. What do you think is the likely outcome of that lawsuit? I, the musician, suing my neighbor, the golfer, because he mows his lawn at 9 a.m. What is the burden upon me to establish that what my neighbor is doing is a nuisance? Mr. Stubbs?
Okay.
No.
Are you talking
to
me?
Yeah.
I thought you said Miss Stubbs.
Yeah. No, I was lucky it was Larrick there, but then I... Okay, go ahead.
I don't think that he would be able to recover because my understanding is correct. You have to prove injury, damages, and that your rights are violated. And he can prove that maybe his rights are violated, maybe this is keeping him sleeping, but is it damage to him?
Well, damaging in the sense of physical damage.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't break my leg. But it's annoying to me, and it's having a serious effect upon my well-being. I don't get a good night's sleep because he's out there mowing his lawn at 9 a.m. But what I was trying to push a little bit, and the other thing you mentioned was that the rights were violated, but sort of rights, whether rights are violated is what's implied, you know. Does my neighbor have a right to mow his lawn? Do I have a right to a good night's sleep? We're trying to figure out where that line is going to be drawn. Again, in Bohan, the plaintiff says it's not my burden to prove that what my neighbor did was negligent, nor do I have to prove that it broke my leg. I can simply show that, gee, all this, you know, all the fumes from this gaslight factory are making my house, miserable. Your impulse, I'm guessing, is that the plaintiffs in Bohan had a good case. I, the musician, however, have a bad case. And what is the difference, Mr. Loback?
Well, for public nuisance, it has to be destroyed.
Okay. Let me just stop for a moment. The term public
nuisance.
Before you go ahead.
That it must be unreasonable and warranted.
Unreasonable. Now, aren't we beginning to kind of drift back? Maybe we were too quick to reject what the defendant said in Bohan. Because after all, what is something negligent if not something unreasonable? So maybe the defendant had a point that the plaintiff should be required to show that the defendant's actions were unreasonable. If we say no to the guy, to the musician, do we not have to say no to the plaintiff in Bohan? Or is there some distinction we can draw as to why the musician loses but the plaintiff in Bohan wins? Ms. Jones? But I'm not sure what innate, as distinguished from, you know, it's innate to lawnmowers that they make noise. Well, why is it that the guy with the lawnmower is okay, but the guy with the gaslight factory is in trouble? I guess I wasn't... Well, we've just switched the perspective here. and you're absolutely right to do that, that the difference, we use the same word reasonable and unreasonable, but notice that the perspective has switched from focusing on the defendant, whether the defendant was reasonable or unreasonable, to focusing on whether the plaintiff has a reasonable expectation. So we look at the plaintiff in Bohan and we say, you know, if you own a home, it's reasonable to expect that your neighbors won't stink up the joint. Whereas if you're a homeowner, it's not reasonable to expect that your neighbors won't start noisy activities until after you've gotten up at 1 in the afternoon. Maybe you're an elderly couple and you go to bed at 7 and you want nobody to be you don't want anybody mowing their lawn after 7, even though there are 2 more hours of daylight in the summertime. And then it's not as hot at 7 at night as it was at 2 in the afternoon. That's when you'd prefer to mow your lawn. Well, the elderly couple may go to bed at 7 at night, but they can't force their neighbors to stop noisy activities so that they can, again, the whole intuitive concept of nuisance is I have a reasonable expectation and my neighbor is not abiding by that. If my neighbor is mowing his lawn at 6 in the morning, I'll probably get that stopped because I have a reasonable expectation that even though he'd prefer a 7 a.m. tea time, most people on a Saturday morning would like a little peace and quiet until, you know, 8 and, well, I don't know exactly when that is, but there's some standard out there. Certainly if he's mowing his lawn at 5 a.m., or he's out with his chainsaw trimming, you know, his tree at 3 in the morning, even though that fits his schedule, we're not going to let him do that. We have a reasonable expectation for a degree of peace and quiet. You want to have, you know, loud parties in your backyard till 3 in the morning? I'm sorry, at some point you're going to have to tone it down. So again, what is confusing about this is that we use the same concept of reasonableness, and if you didn't watch the pea being moved from one walnut shell to another, you would have missed the fact that, gee, we're talking about reasonableness in both contexts, but reasonableness of the defendant's conduct, that is, the defendant in Bohan was doing this great public service of giving us gaslight so we can, you know, turn the night into day. Nothing unreasonable, and he's using all the latest technology. It's a state-of-the-art plant, but it produces these noxious smells. And his neighbors have a right to complain. Okay, Mr. Jones.
Well, so we're back to this reasonableness idea. Is this something that a jury would have to decide is a reasonable expectation on the part of the plaintiff?
Typically, nuisance cases are, again, to sort of go back in English history here for a moment, there's a difference between the courts of law and the courts of equity. So-called equitable remedies, where the judges, where what the court does is not to impose a judgment of money damages, but the judge has these equitable powers to actually order you to do things, to issue an injunction. These are called equitable remedies as opposed to damage remedies. And in fact, that's precisely what we get into in the next case of Boomer. The difference between those two, they have historical roots in part because the equitable remedies were imposed by the kings or the queens, the crown's chancellor. Those of you who know the story of Thomas More, a man for all seasons, he was the Lord Chancellor of England, serving Henry VIII. The position of the Chancellor, as you may recall from the movie or what have you, his predecessor was Cardinal Wolsey, Bishop. The connection between the office of the Lord Chancellor and the ecclesiastical authority, there wasn't as clear a line as there is now. The powers of equity were in addition to legal remedies, so that the chancellor acting through equity could essentially use the power of the crown, for that matter, the power of the church, to make people do things that were right and equitable. They didn't have the same kind of narrow channels of the legal remedies, which were limited to making people pay damages or surrender property. And the whole history of how the crown and the local court authorities worked out their differences, the boundary line, has become a very complex one. You'll study it in civil procedure. It has to do with, getting back to your question, the right to a trial by jury. It turns out that the right to a trial by jury attaches only to those legal remedies, remedies at law, for which juries were assigned. By contrast, the equitable remedies of whether the court orders the bulldozers to stop before they tear down a historic landmark, or the court orders a prison system to be reformed to avoid, you know, violation of constitutional rights, or a judge orders a school district to redistrict its schools to avoid segregation, these equitable powers of the judges, that is a world in which juries play no part. And again, exactly where those boundary lines are drawn and how they interact is a matter of some difficulty. On that note, why don't we talk for a moment about Boomer, and we actually need to... We may be able to do Boomer and Spur, I don't know, leaving us with a little bit of... dog bite case tomorrow, but in any event, let's talk about Boomer and sort of tie these together here in terms of the equitable and legal remedies. Ms. Lyric, why don't you tell us about Boomer?
Okay, the defendant offered to launch the next plant near Albany, and the plaintiff, our neighboring nuisance was found at trial, allowing temporary damages. They were also, but that was denied. And permanent damages were awarded in the amount of $25,000.
Okay. So the question here is, first of all, is this a nuisance? When the plaintiffs, and again, basically it's the same diagram here, defendants operating this cement plant, it imposes these dust and vibration and so forth upon the plaintiff. Plaintiff says, we shouldn't be expected to put up with this. Is that a nuisance?
Technically, it was a nuisance. When I thought about this case, the court sorted it out.
And the plaintiff appeals that to say you can't split it up this way. If we were wrong about claiming it were a nuisance, then okay, we lose on it. But if you find that it's a nuisance, we get a full remedy, and the full remedy is not just to get paid for the damages, but to make the defendant stop doing this thing. What does the appellate court do?
The appellate court, they were concerned, the trial court was concerned with the fact that they shut the plant down, it would be a third. As far as financial
Okay. And so are we talking about the Court of Appeals here? What is the Court of Appeals, what's their rationale for leaving that alone? They affirmed the trial court's judgment of splitting these remedies. What's their explanation?
Well, they said that if the payment wasn't made,
okay. Well, there's a, maybe we can get at it through the dissenting opinion. What does the dissenting opinion say?
The dissenting opinion says that the defendants are continuing to do harm to their neighbors, but basically the courts are saying that's okay as long as you don't pay them for it. And then
yeah, it seems like sort of an odd thing that somebody walks off with my cell phone, and I say, wait a minute, and the person says, I'll pay you for it. No, wait a minute, if this is mine, if it's something I'm entitled to, I get to decide how and if I'm going to transfer it. Even if your need is great, you don't have the right to simply appropriate my stuff with the proviso that I can recover damages for the loss that I've suffered. Why do we let the cement company do that here? To let them impose these damages on the plaintiff without, and all they have to do is pay for it. Now, let's assume for the moment that it's full compensation, that they are being adequate. You own a piece of property with all the cement dust and the vibration. It's worth this much. If it weren't for the cement dust and the vibration, it would be worth this much more. You get paid the difference. Theoretically, I've been fully compensated. Why do we do that? This is reminiscent of what previous case? Yeah, of Hammondtree versus Jenner. Coordinate branch of government. You know, we're just judges. We're not the now it's turning not to the legislature, it's turning to the executive branch, to the people with technical expertise, the people who have the authority and the competence to measure levels of air pollution. By making the defendants pay damages to the plaintiff, we're not saying that they can continue in perpetuity. They're still answerable to the EPA, and if the EPA shuts them down, well, that's their tough luck. They, in effect, are allowed to purchase, if you were studying property simultaneously, this is one area where I poach on the territory of the property course. Property deals with the way you can slice up property interests into different, they call it a bundle of sticks, you know, and so the right to mine coal or the right to fly airplanes over your house or all sorts of different rights, the rights to run a sewer pipe. Okay, now the cement company has bought the right to dump dust and vibration on your property. But that right may turn out to be worthless if the EPA says you can't do it, but the court says they're a lot smarter than we are. And if they choose to shut down the cement plant, fine. But if they choose not to do it, better they make that decision than we do. What would be the plaintiff's response to the defendant's assurance that we can trust the EPA to make these kinds of decisions? Ms. Woodruff?
It takes a long time to make these decisions, so it's not going to be made in a week, a year, 2 years, 10 years.
And how does the EPA make decisions? Politically. They are a branch of government that is answerable to the various, you know, lobbying pressures. And, you know, the plaintiff would say that forcing me to entrust my rights to some political body, that's not the American system. If somebody wants to take my cell phone, I don't go appeal to the, you know, FCC to find out who's the better person to own my cell phone. But that's the plaintiff's argument. At the same time, we have all of these agencies, the FAA, the National Highway Transportation Safety Board, we have all kinds of different federal, the FDA, and so forth, all of these agencies with specialized expertise. Isn't it better that those people make the call about how we balance these competing interests and rights? I don't know what levels of air pollution are harmful to your health. And if you put a black robe on me and put me in a courtroom, I'm not a whole lot better off in terms of making that decision than standing here in front of you. Again, the whole question about whether our rights are better entrusted to courts or that we entrust these decisions to people with technical expertise, with the flexibility to do rulemaking and hold hearings and change their mind about things and grant variances and do all sorts of stuff like that, are we better off or worse off? As we have the argument about should this go to the legislature or should it be a matter for the courts, there's still a fairly significant political argument going on. And it's a tough question for the judge to, as with the question about what to pass to the legislature and what to take on by the court, you have to make some sort of assessment of which issues belong in your bailiwick and which do not. Technically, again, the decision of the judge in equity, making a judgment on equitable grounds, the judge gets to consider a wide variety of sort of fairness questions. And looming large in the court's mind is the question of whether the cement company making this plant, providing a lot of jobs to the community, is it really fair to say to them, well, you're going to have to dismantle this plant or apply all of these expensive measures we've just figured out you needed, when at the time they built this plant, it seemed like a pretty good idea. And people weren't as sensitive as they are now about the effects of air pollution. So when the judge says, in effect, sitting in equity, I can't bring myself to impose an injunction that would make them stop, I do think the plaintiffs are entitled to compensation, but beyond that I will not go. As Judge Jason says in dissent, I mean, you could easily agree with Judge Jason in finding that that's kind of a wimpy cop-out, or you could think it's the path of wisdom. Again, the whole question about how much we want to entrust decisions like this, same thing with such things as who gets access to the airwaves or what channels show up on your cable station or your cable network. Who controls the people that get to offer cable TV or satellite TV, or how is all of that regulated? Do you trust the Federal Communications Commission to represent the public interest, or are you worried that groups like that are likely to reflect the most powerful, you know, political forces, and you'd really be better off in a system that had more clearly defined rights that couldn't be as easily manipulated? Same issue, for example, with zoning questions. How do we decide whether somebody gets to build a new Walmart out in the countryside there, and when we're going to impose growth restrictions so that we can preserve our quality of life? We entrust that to the Planning Commission. There's a body of law dealing with land use planning. In fact, there's a whole course devoted to that subject. But it's pretty much a kind of smoke-filled room process by which planning commissions decide, oh, yes, you can build your shopping center, or no, you can't build your shopping center, or you can build your shopping center so long as you do these five different mitigation things to preserve the quality of life. Can you get a variance from a zoning thing? All of these issues have become, in effect, in most cities or areas, they're political decisions. There are X number of people who sit on the planning commission. They're appointed or elected, or somehow they get there. They're not judges. They don't operate on the they operate on the basis of some sort of generic public interest. Can Gonzaga build the addition to the arena over here? As you pass, if you come down this way, you'll pass the sign. If you come down Nevada, there's a sign out there essentially saying the public is entitled to go appear before the Planning Commission to express their views on whether Gonzaga gets to build a new arena. I'm reasonably confident Gonzaga will get to build, you know, this new arena. They'll find that's in the public interest. And if you live across the street and say, oh, but there's going to be so much more traffic, blah, 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 well, they're going to say, too bad. We like it. Whereas, again, and you're you could easily ask the question, is this, you know, are my property rights being respected? The political process, in effect, decides land use questions. Is there an alternative to that? I'm not sure there is. But again, in lots of different areas, the question about how you find boundaries to property rights is very much up for grabs. Mr. Christopoulos. Well, I think what Judge, and it's a good point, the dissenting opinion compares this to a form of condemnation. That is, if you're familiar with the public, the exercise of eminent domain, if the state, or I forget exactly who it is, decides they're going to build a north-south freeway in Spokane, which they have decided when this happens, not entirely clear, but out near the Kaiser plant, closer to where I live, you know, there are these huge mounds of dirt getting ready for this interchange to connect the north-south freeway, but we don't know where it's going to be built from I-90 going north to get up that far. But if they've got to run through your backyard to build that freeway, they will exercise eminent domain, and they have the right, the Fifth Amendment recognizes the right, to take private property, but it has to be for a public use, and it has to be with compensation. Here there's compensation. But what Judge Jason points out in dissent is that he's not convinced it's for a public use. This is not the state of Pennsylvania or the city of Albany that is taking this property. It's the cement plant. Since when did they become eligible to declare eminent domain? As though somebody walked off with my cell phone and said, I'm declaring eminent domain here. No, it doesn't work that way. Now, there's another species of entity we do give that power to, in effect, and those are public utilities. If they decide they need to build a new high voltage transmission line and run it across my property, they may either take my property or get an easement, or they may have to run an underground thing for a new sewer line or what have you. They may take my property for a public utility, water, you know, sewer, etc. It's not the government, but it's a utility that operates in this area. But again, that's a limited class of entities that have that power, in effect, of eminent domain. Extending it to declare the cement company to be part of the, you know, in effect, a public utility. But I think the logic of the court is somewhat along those lines, that the benefit to the community of having a cement plant is almost sort of analogous to the benefit of having a high voltage transmission line. Sure, we could get along without it, but there's so much benefit for it that, well, yeah, so long as these people are compensated, we're not going to get all bent out of shape over the fact that they didn't want this and it's being crammed down their throat. Again, the interaction of public interest, private interest, use of governmental power to favor some people, disfavor others, is very much part of our modern dilemma. Mr. Springfield? Correct. And again, what the court does, as was said earlier, is to separate the damages remedy from the equitable remedy of an injunction. And just to sort of finish that story, we do Spur Industries here at the end. Funny, I was just in Phoenix and I forgot to go out and visit Sun City there. I just sort of... Okay, good. So I could lay my own eyes on this wonderful property here. Ms. Russell, why don't you tell us about Spur, if you've gotten that far. I'm sorry, you're Ms. Russell. I beg your pardon. Go ahead. Okay. In one sense, it's like Boomer in that you've got the defendant, the feedlot, generating all these noxious smells, the plaintiff complaining about it. What's different between this case and Boomer? Okay, you have this feature to the case, the doctrine of coming to the nuisance. And why is that relevant? Why do we care about the sequence of who was there first and who was there second? Yeah. Okay, that's the sort of fairness argument. Let's go back to the technical definition. What is a nuisance? A nuisance is, in 25 words or less here, tell me again, what is, how do we define or describe a nuisance? Yeah. Well, flesh that out for me. Something that's annoying or offensive that... Yes. it's something that's annoying or offensive that interferes with the plaintiff's reasonable expectation to be free from this kind of annoyance or offense. So again, I can reasonably expect that my neighbor won't operate his chainsaw at 6 o'clock in the morning. Why does someone who comes to the nuisance not get the same benefit as someone who is sitting there and the nuisance comes to them? Why, under that definition, would it make sense to differentiate the timing? It's a question of whether they did or didn't violate that reasonable. If you are thinking about moving to an area where everybody has horses, they all have 5-acre parcels, it's out in the country, and, you know, horses generate noises and smells and etc. If you move into this neighborhood and then start complaining about the fact, well, these horses make all these noises and generate all these smells, people would look at you and say, well, what did you think you were getting into? It would no longer be reasonable for you if you came to the nuisance. Okay, so again, the court makes a big deal about the timing and the sequence of this. Apparently you've got Phoenix here, and there's Sun City. What's the relationship to Northwest? Okay, so you've got Sun City up here. And the court says that if the city of Phoenix had grown incrementally, and then you got the feedlot over here, now somehow or other, Del Webb managed to sell all these lots, and since it must have been when the wind was blowing that way, or whatever it was, or they bought it over the internet or something, so that if they buy the property, then they move in, then it stinks. So the court makes it clear that if it had been a case where gradually the city expanded and people started building houses next to the feedlot would just have to go. But because Del Webb, following General MacArthur's strategy in the Second World War, you know, leapfrogged way ahead of where the development was, bought this property way out in the middle of nowhere, next to the feedlot, the court says a different rule applies. Now you've come to the nuisance. But what remedy, or what's the court's disposition of the case? How does this case turn out? Okay, so Del Webb is happy that an injunction is being imposed, but there's sort of a silver lining to that cloud. What does the court tell Del Webb is the bad news? So we've done just the reverse of Boomer. In Boomer, the plaintiff got damages but no injunction. In Spur Industries, they get an injunction but no damages. In fact, the damages are reversed. Del Webb now has to pay Spur to leave. Del Webb, I guess, is happy about this because now, for a relatively modest sum of paying Spur Industries to move to the Texas Panhandle or wherever God intended that there would be feedlots, Del Webb has avoided these lawsuits to rescind all the real estate transactions, etc. Why couldn't they have cut this deal in the first place? Why wouldn't Spur, getting paid to move someplace, have been happy with that deal? Why did it take litigation to get here, Mr. Jones?
Because each side thought they would win. So
okay.
Why make a deal if you think you're going to win?
And what would have happened to Spur if Del Webb had lost? The Molly?
They could have been chased out again. But if they were to move, they would have been.
But suppose the court said, you came to the nuisance, you can't complain about it. As to you, it's not a nuisance. The feedlot is entitled to stay there unmolested. Then what?
They could have demanded that Del Webb pay him a whole lot more for their private
class meal
than they paid him more money.
That's right. If you can take my cell phone and only pay me the fair market value of my cell phone, well, it might be that you have a need sufficiently great that it makes economic sense for you to simply, okay, I'll pay you the $40 or whatever that cell phone is worth, and I'm going to use it, and that's great. On the other hand, if I can force you to pay my price, and I realize that you just won the lottery, but you've got, you know, 5 minutes to call in and claim your and I know that it's worth $100,000 to you to make that call in 5 minutes, and I'm the only way you can do that, well, I can begin to get something closer to what you're willing to pay. Classic sort of negotiation technique of, but so I'd much rather be in a position where I own the right, and I can sell that right at a price I choose, as distinguished from being limited to forced to sell it at its fair market value. So you're absolutely right. The feedlot said, before you chase us out of here, you got to pay something closer to what I think you would be willing to pay if you had to name my price. Now the feedlot is forced to move and they don't get that premium. Del Webb gambled and won. Now, perhaps like the cement company, Del Webb is doing a public service, ought to be congratulated for his entrepreneurial spirit, and Spur Industries should be satisfied with getting the cost of a move when, in some sense, they could have been told, you get nothing. Your place stinks up the joint. But of course the court recognizes that would be inequitable. Absent the gradual move of, now think about what would happen if you said, once having established a feedlot out in the middle of nowhere, even the gradual expansion of the population would constitute coming to the nuisance, and the feedlot can just stay there until somebody makes them an offer that they find attractive. Well, then you'd kind of have an incentive to go out and buy property in the middle of nowhere, establish some stinky operation, and hold this over the head of the people who are your neighbors, that they would, so long as you get there first, they would then have to buy you out. So the court recognizes that simply by establishing something that's annoying and offensive, but doing it first, the coming to the nuisance doctrine is only a relative one. It's a way of saying where the plaintiff has essentially asked for this particular form of annoyance and so forth, that has to be taken into consideration. That forms part of the basis of deciding what the plaintiff's reasonable expectations would be. By contrast, the people that own the property around the feedlot would have some rights if, over time, their property became eligible to be turned into a subdivision. Again, all of these things are sort of subject to the rule of what would be a reasonable expectation. Mr. Gallard?
Whole concept of nuisance
will
link to property rights.
Yes.
Is that right?
Absolutely. And again, that's a good point of distinguishing the strict liability for an abnormally dangerous activity happens out on the highway. So I'm out on the highway, I get incinerated by a tanker truck full of gasoline. If I can prove it's an abnormally dangerous activity, I get to recover for that. Nuisance, on the other hand, is tied to my enjoying some kind of a property right. I'm sitting in my own coal mine, minding my own business. Or I'm sitting on in my backyard in Sun City, and the stink, you know, comes wafting across the plains there. It's because I enjoy a property right that I can claim that my neighbor is in violation of those property rights, and I have this heightened expectation. Okay, why don't we pick up at that point tomorrow? And I'll try to remember tomorrow to bring a little sort of abbreviated, in fact, I think I'll email that to you. I'll email you a sort of mini outline of Chapter 1 so that if that hasn't already been distributed to you by the tutors, I'll give you essentially what we've covered so far, and we can talk about it a little tomorrow morning.
We won't be getting into Chapter 2.
Yes, we actually will. After we finish with dogs tomorrow, we're going to talk about the opening of Chapter 2. So go ahead and read Mitchell versus Gonzalez, right? No. The exam will be from 9 to 10, and then the next installment will be at 4 when... we have the exam grading. Is everybody okay with exam soft and all that kind of stuff? Good.